Hello and welcome to Branch West Live number 401.
This week on the podcast, the Biden administration is hell-bent on up to 1 year of big structural change, which is actually the opposite of structural change.
And Biden debuts Infrastructure Month, which is exactly like Infrastructure Week in that it gets nothing accomplished. It's just much longer.
Plus, someone is about to have to take 4 months off of work to decide a question with a simple answer. Is Donald Trump a criminal? Yes.
And the battle of the working class origin stories is coming to a Florida Senate primary near you.
Plus, there's no one who wants Donald Trump to die more than Matt Gaetz. Pass it on.
And Tom Perez is joining Jay Carney in union busting hell.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Branch West Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.branchestlive.com.
And in the same room.
This is our first time recording this podcast from the same room in 1 year.
Yeah.
More than 1 year, really.
More than.
A year and 2 months.
Yeah.
It's been a little confusing.
It has.
We did not know how to set up any of the tech.
I know. We're not recording it because we had just been recording Zooms.
Right.
Which we're not doing right now. So we're going to have to, if you've been loving us on YouTube, which you haven't been.
Right. You might check back and see what it's been like. It's been great.
Yeah. I forgot how to read already.
Yeah. No. Well, it's reading numbers especially has been challenging already today.
Right. My brain stopped working when I had to decide whether to say 401 or 401.
Well, he had to do that all while pressing a button while I was looking at him. And I think that was just too much pressure.
I'm feeling like a lot of pressure of you in the same room.
You know, for like 8 years, we just did this in the same room.
I do know that.
Literal,
yes.
Like, that's enough that we could have gone to high school and college in that time. That's the amount of time we did it in the same room.
Oh my God.
1 year, everything fell apart.
Yeah.
But we're looking forward to a summer of just same room podcasting. Up a storm. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
This was a pretty slow news week, I think because it's Memorial Day.
Probably.
Or just because we weren't reading the news. Who can know?
Right. Well, you traveled this week.
I traveled this week. Right. I was on an airplane. I was on a full airplane. It was filled to the brim with people.
Oh, that's weird.
It was really weird, but also not as weird as I thought it would be.
That's good.
Because my experience flying during the pandemic was terrifying, even though there were no people. And so once I was like, I'm the vaccinated one. If these people aren't vaccinated, that's on them.
Yeah.
Everyone can be vaccinated, and I am. So it's actually them that are taking their lives in their hands, and I'm just flying.
Right, exactly.
I just had to repeat that to myself multiple times.
Good.
Which distracted me from how I'm terrified of flying, so it's fine.
Oh, that worked out great then.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the one thing that did happen this week is it was the anniversary of George Floyd's death.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of discussion about what, if anything, we've accomplished in the last year.
Which is minimal things.
Minimal things. George Floyd's family met with the White House and with Nancy Pelosi because there was supposed to be a policing bill with his name that had a deadline of the first anniversary of his death.
Yep.
That is just out there not being passed.
Yeah, we've blown right by that, as you would expect. I mean,
yeah. This bill does like the bare minimum. It like ends chokeholds.
Yeah.
Which is like all we can apparently get together to do.
Right. I mean, there's obviously the huge discussion around qualified immunity. And then also just sort of like, you know, we've said this a million times on the podcast, but just it's going to be a theme actually, because we're going to talk about it in the budget too. But just any sort of like actual structural change to what policing looks like is nowhere near. I mean, the U.S. Congress is nowhere near that. I mean, there are some cities across the country that are sort of thinking about that. But like in terms of like passing a bill that is going to be signed by this president, like that's not a thing that's going to be happening.
These are not people that are. Well, this is a man who had Eric Garner's family on a Blue Lives Matter panel. So during the DNC. So
right.
I don't.
Looked her right in the eye and told her that not all cops are bad.
Right. Exactly. So I'm not shocked to hear that we're not expecting big structural change.
No, me.
I think that a lame policing bill that does almost nothing should be something they could set their sights on and at least accomplish. It doesn't do anything, so it should be easy to vote for.
Yeah, right.
But here we are.
But I, you know, in the interviews and the press conference, like after this meeting, because they also met with like, you know, I think Tim Scott and even Lindsey Graham and some of these people, like everyone seemed fairly confident that they would be able to pass this. Like all of George Floyd's family that like was doing interviews, like seemed very upbeat. So it was sort of like hard to not feel upbeat about it also, but like, you
just
know,
do
it's
it.
Well, that's the other thing. It's like, can we just vote on this? It already passed the House. I mean, they just need 10 Republicans. Yet again, another bill that we just need 10 Republicans on. It's
going great. Having 50 Republicans. Going super great.
God. Oh, man.
We also got Biden's budget this week.
Listen.
It's a lot of money.
So much money.
All of it oriented to stuff that will help some people for 1 year.
Yeah, I mean, look, I was having trouble finding links that, like, really had everything listed out, like, where the big chunks were going to. The biggest chunk is military spending, obviously, in an uptick from last year. So, like, remember when we were talking about how we were hopeful that maybe we would literally cut it by, like, 20%?
Yeah.
You know, like, no.
We raised it.
We raised
it. It's like
it
the times that they said that we needed to change policing, so they raised police budgets.
Right, exactly.
That's basically what we did, but for the police of the world.
Yeah, exactly. And so I was looking through this list, and it's sort of like, you know, I wrote down $36.5 billion for Title I schools, because that's like a big chunk. There's like $14 billion like going across agencies to like help fight the climate crisis. But as I was taking all these notes, I was like, well, I can't write down every $2 billion that gets us to $6 trillion, because that will be like a 7-hour podcast that will bore you to tears.
Right.
But that sort of like led me to like my realization that maybe all of this $6 trillion isn't super money well spent. And yeah. I don't mean to say that like some of this isn't necessary. There's a whole laundry list of like places where like that do need money. There's a lot of money going to like tribal infrastructure, and there's a lot, you know, I mean, like there's a ton of money going to like fixing the opioid crisis, and you know, so I'm not even here to fight with anybody about like whether this money is going to be used in a positive way. But like, it's just, you know, there's no, what's not in there is like any sort of mention or pathway to a public option.
Right.
And even really
meaningful healthcare reform that would actually lower costs for people.
Which was a campaign promise. You know, all it does is that like in the overview of the budget, he calls on Congress to enact like healthcare initiatives, like lowering prescription drug costs by allowing Medicare to negotiate prices and creating a public health insurance option, giving those age 60 and older the option to enroll in Medicare. But like, there's no, all he does is request
right.
that
he
Congress
doesn't put money into these
doesn't
priorities.
Doesn't allocate money. Right, exactly. And yeah, so, and the budget itself doesn't have any, not only does it not provide funding, but there's, you know, there's nothing that would like tell
guidance.
You how to achieve those actual aims, right? Yeah. So there's not any mention of raising the minimum wage to $15. There's not any mention of, there's nothing in there about canceling any student loans at all. He himself said that he was intending to do $10,000, which everyone thought was not enough, but like that was at least a campaign promise of his. And
to
that's
be fair,
not
it was made under great duress.
It was.
Because he doesn't believe in doing that,
right.
even in
well,
the slightest.
Well, same with the minimum wage
right.
to $15, made under
right.
great duress. And only
he's
just,
not interested.
He only said it to get Bernie Sanders to come on and like, you know, act like he was, you know, he looked like a POW in that interview with Biden, remember? But like, that was the, like, that, but that was all about sort of like, that was the first thing that I asked Joe Biden when I was going to endorse him was whether he would, you know, raise the minimum wage to $15. He doesn't fucking care.
No. He doesn't believe that these things should happen. It's not
right.
even that he doesn't care.
Right.
These are not things that Joe Biden believes to be true.
Right.
Like, he doesn't think that the minimum wage should be raised, because if he did think that the minimum wage should be raised $15 an hour, that's a point he could have been advocating years ago. He
right.
That's been a point that has been widely popular with Democrats for like
yeah.
a decade now.
Yeah.
You know, if he believed in canceling student debt, he could have made that promise without people having to cajole him into doing it.
Well, and that's the thing. And he doesn't even need that to pass Congress. That
no,
pretty
he
much
could just
everyone
do it.
Believes that he could do that, you know, with
yeah. unilaterally.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So I think what I have learned here, and we talked about this at least to some degree in the COVID bill that he signed, which, you know, everybody is talking about, you know, decreasing childhood poverty by 50%, but just for a year,
right.
you know,
so one year of childhood poverty,
none of those things are permanent. They're saying that they would like to make them permanent, and like,
yeah,
we'd good
all
luck
like
trying,
to-
I guess. But you know, this, you know, he has talked a lot about like how he feels like he needs to be sort of like an FDR type of president, and I would agree. But spending $6 trillion, which is the most that we've spent since World War II, is not the answer, because the difference between like what this $6 trillion is and what any budget that FDR would have put forward is that
yeah.
like those are things that are like still in our lives now.
Instead
and they're
of
like
programs.
Huge, huge, massive like structural programs that like changed people's lives for the entirety of their lives. And like not one thing in this budget or in the COVID bill are that.
Yeah.
And I want to shake him because it's like, if you're trying to be FDR, you're doing it wrong.
Well, and this is also not a way to get people to start feeling like their investment in the federal government pays off, because totally. These kinds of small funding, small funding mechanisms and small programs that are targeted or whatever, they don't allow anyone to tell a broad story about how American lives have been uplifted generally by this presidency.
Yeah.
They make it really hard to tell the story of how great this money was for everybody. Instead, everyone feels like they got nothing for their money, which is a big problem that Americans rightfully have with the way that we're taxed.
Totally.
We very rightfully feel like we don't get anything for our money. We don't get healthcare. We don't get educations, higher educations. We don't get childcare. I mean, there are so many things that even when we get them in a piecemeal, confusing way. We get them in ways that exclude people who really need them. And it's important to have money that is spent targeting the people that need it the most, of course. But you cannot just target people who need things the most when everyone needs so much. You have to make some big investments in everybody.
Yeah.
And he fails to sort of, it's related to why I hate Pete Buttigieg. I don't think that you knew that was where I was going with this, but Pete Buttigieg, the reason I hate him is he inherently doesn't believe in the value of public goods. He doesn't believe that public education is a public good. His argument for why we shouldn't fund billionaires' children's education proves that he doesn't believe education is a public good. And Joe Biden similarly doesn't believe that these kinds of public structural program, change programs are public goods. He doesn't believe in the idea that things like healthcare and like college educations and like pre-K and, all of the sort of childcare funding that we need. He doesn't really believe in them as public goods. He believes in them as targeted programs to help the neediest.
Yeah.
And what actually uplifts everyone is believing in the value of public goods, and also what makes everyone think their taxes are worthwhile. What makes them feel proud to pay their taxes instead of annoyed that they're sending money to the government so that we can bomb other countries and getting nothing for it is the idea that they're getting public goods in exchange for that. That's the reason that people in Europe are willingly paying what are actually similar tax rates to us, but without complaining about them, is because they're getting something for them. And it's so hard to make the argument that brings people into the money spending frame of mind. And I'm very into the money spending frame of mind.
And he is too.
It's hard to make that argument when you can't point to any simple, structural change that actually uplifted everyone.
Yeah.
You have to actually give individuals, no one is paying taxes out of the goodness of their heart. Everyone wants to feel like they got something for living in this society. That's fair. That's human.
It is.
I don't know what to say about that.
Yep.
People want to feel like they're invested for a reason. Like, this feels like a bad investment. And they make it hard for you to feel like it's a good investment because the only people who are getting the benefit of the investment, like in a clear way, are people that can't afford to pay the taxes in the first place. And that is why you have all of these people who are so angry about their tax rates.
Yeah.
Because you obviously have to help the people that can't afford to pay the taxes in the first place. But you can't make it feel like we're not invested in everyone else.
Yeah.
In any case, I think this is actually, though, to some extent, partly a problem with the way the left is even discussing funding priorities. I think this is sort of a broad Democratic problem. I've been thinking this a lot.
It is. I mean, it gets to the heart of also sort of like identity politics, because that's what these are. I mean, they're in budget form, but I mean, it's
the same moderate Democratic approach to, where it's like,
it's like the budget version of Nancy Pelosi putting on her kente cloth.
Yes, exactly. Like,
to go and, honor George Floyd.
Right. And I think the left often gets duped by these kinds of, symbolic gestures, because meaningful structural change actually means more to everyone, including the communities that need investment the most.
Of course.
But if you're not willing to think broadly that way and you're bought off by like dumb gestures, then you lose the ability to inherently advocate for everybody. Like, it's just, it's something that the moderate wing of the Democratic Party pulls on us all the time,
you
guys.
All the time. And also I think it's important to remember also, like, just for context too, I think people like get scared away by some of these big programs and thinking that like they're going to be like, bankrupt the entire country, which, first off, don't worry about that, because that's not a thing.
We have infinite money, don't worry about
it. It's a separate conversation that we reference a lot.
Brent's reading the deficit myth, so don't worry about it.
Right. But also, like, to cancel just $10,000 of student loans, which is what which was what his own campaign promise was, would cost about $200 billion. And that's like a drop in the pan of this entire budget. It's like, you know, less than a third of what we're spending on the fucking military. Like, and that would change, like, literally, you know, most of the country's lives infinitely in ways that you, like, can't even imagine. Like, think of literally what you would do with, like, $10,000 less of a loan that you owe right now. I mean, you would buy a fucking car. You would buy a house. You would do it. I mean, like,
think about the things that you would do if you had the freedom to not be in debt. Right. Because this would erase not enough of the country's
debt. Go figure, a man from Delaware wants people to continue to be in debt.
Someone from the tax haven of Delaware would want people to continue to be in debt. That's good for business in the tax haven of Delaware.
Yeah.
But I'm like, actually, this is something that I can speak to as someone who graduated without debt. I know exactly what kinds of options that opened up for me that were not open to friends of mine who had debt from the moment they graduated.
Yeah.
I could make choices about my career that were riskier. I could try to go into a field that I thought I might really enjoy. Like, I could move. I could do all of these things that other people couldn't do because they owed $200 a month from, like, the moment they graduated from college. That, even just that freedom, that's a quality of life improvement we could be giving young people who, by the way, are living in, like, the shittiest possible economy, in the shittiest possible situation, in a pandemic, and in a Great Depression.
Right.
Like, they deserve, if nothing else, the quality of life improvement that would offer. You know, it would especially for people that are coming out of the public universities, it would cover a lot of their, it would cover a lot of public university debt.
I went to a public university and paid, you know, which was obviously far less expensive than the education that you got, like, and paid student loans until what felt like the end of time. I mean,
remember that you were paying student loans until
40,
the end of time.
It was not that long ago.
No, exactly. That's for most of our friendship, Brent was paying off student loans from a public university.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the quality of life improvement would drastically change the way that Americans were able to live.
Yeah.
So there are like ancillary benefits to a lot of these large scale programs also that I think people don't think about. It's like, actually there was, somebody did a program like this with healthcare where they had, you know, it was like an experiment in like Oregon or something. I remember from like years ago where they gave, you know, they were running a program for homeless individuals in, I don't know, like Portland or something like that. And half of them, they just gave healthcare to, no questions asked, didn't ask for anything, no one had to qualify. It was just like, you got it.
Yeah.
And then the other half, they kind of used the whatever program that, you know, whatever qualifications you have to use for like the Medicaid program in the state.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that people got richer under the healthcare program, but they were like infinitely happier. Like, everyone was just happier.
Well, go figure. Every country that has a program like that, like, is always way higher than us on a happiness scale.
So, like, these are even things that, like, have non-cost-related benefits.
Yeah.
That are, so, in any case, dream bigger is all we're saying.
Right.
That's, if you have $6 billion to throw around.
Trillion.
I mean, $6 trillion to kajillion. Throw around. Right. If you have six kajillion dollars, six infinity dollars to throw around, throw it to the things that matter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
In any case.
Oh boy.
Also, it's infrastructure month.
I feel like both of the last couple of weeks have been incensed about like what's going on with this infrastructure bill. And I feel as though
you might be forever.
I might be forever, but I also might not have the energy any longer. So there's a chance that maybe I won't be able to get there on this podcast. I probably will. Let's be honest with ourselves.
Yeah.
But like, I'm just so over it.
Yeah. I think the main point that we would probably seek to make in our continuing discussion of the infrastructure bill is just like, don't worry about what the Republicans are going to do, because it's nothing.
And even, and the thing,
don't talk
that, like,
to them.
Right.
Don't be involved in them. Don't meet with them.
Right. And there's some things that like are annoying specifically about this week, because, you know, last week we talked about how Biden brought his from something to like 1.7 down from 2.3 trillion.
Yeah.
Right.
Just and out of the blue.
And the Republicans had been at like 500 billion. So like they were still like miles away. Well, they came back with a counteroffer, which actually is sort of surprising because there were some rumors that maybe they just like wouldn't even bother.
Right.
And it's 928 billion. So they're still, you know, almost $1 trillion apart here.
Yeah.
So, but now this is just going to make it keep dragging on, because now by next week is going to meet with them again.
That's right.
When they get back. And they're all actually pretending as though like this is a real, you know, counteroffer, which it's not. But Shelley Moore Capito, who is, you know, leading this charge, said this week when they released it, she said, "We believe this counteroffer delivers on what President Biden told us in the Oval Office that day, and that is to try to reach somewhere near $1 trillion over an 8-year period that would include our baseline spending."
So they came in just under.
Wait a fucking minute, though, also.
Mm-hmm.
Because do we want a $2.3 trillion infrastructure spending bill, or do we want a $1 trillion infrastructure spending bill?
I think you know the answer to this.
And I guess on some level, like, maybe good on him for going in with 2.3 to get to 1,
right.
I guess. This is the thing that we ask them to do all right. the time, I guess, maybe. If he really wanted $1 trillion, I'm surprised he didn't say $1 trillion and end up with $250 billion. So, like, maybe good,
learned the
I
lesson
guess.
Of the Clintons.
Right? But also, I'm kind of like, why is he telling them privately something completely the opposite of, like, what he claims to both stand for and that everybody thinks is, like, Politico is reporting that both parties assume that this is going to get passed through reconciliation. So, like, they are doing this.
Right,
as,
so
like,
don't even ask them.
They're doing that. Like, this is all kabuki theater here because neither of the negotiating parties actually believe that they're going to come to any sort of commitment here. Like,
That's like, at the end of the day, they are not going to get 10 Republicans on board for infrastructure because the Republicans don't believe in spending on anything at the moment because they're just being obstructionists. So this feels like an effort that is ultimately going to make them look like weak negotiators because they're going to have gone through the trouble of going down to a trillion after starting at 2.3 trillion.
Yeah.
And then they're going to not get any Republican votes.
Yeah, exactly. And then they're going to be stuck with a $1 trillion plan passing through budget reconciliation.
But as we've discussed on the podcast before, this is obviously the number that they went to Manchin and Sinema with.
Right.
So
probably so.
Like the Republicans actually might be irrelevant to this conversation.
They might be. Yeah. They may have. Joe Manchin would have said, like, I'll vote for something around $1 trillion.
Yes. And then that is here we are. Where we ended up.
But, you know, because the thing that I think is also important to think about when we're talking about them negotiating with the Republicans, and again, we've mentioned this, but, like, you know, even if they get to a number that they, like, are both okay with, like, the Republicans are paying for it with just, like, random unspent, like, discretionary spending, and then also, like, money that's left over from various COVID bills that, like, never got assigned to go anywhere or whatever. So, like, they aren't even actually, I think in this entire almost $1 trillion plan, they only have, like, something between, like, $1 and $200 billion of, like, new spending. So, like, they're not even. And then assuming that you do get to a place, like, Biden obviously wants to pay for the whole thing with tax increases, and they won't go up one single solitary point on the tax rate. So, like, it's
a
joke.
Here's what I think would be a baller move.
Oh.
I've just come up with this. So if it's not baller, don't blame me. It's a random brain flash that I've just had.
Uh-huh.
If he goes with the $1 billion figure, but pays for the whole thing with tax increases on millionaires.
Yeah.
So that because I think what he needs to do is show that it's possible to just raise taxes anyway. So that they can just quiet down.
Yeah.
Because they can complain about it to their heart's content, but they're going to complain about it no matter what. So they're going to complain about it whether or not he taxes millionaires. And I feel like what he needs to do is be like, is sort of put the call out to millionaires, like, I'm going to tax you. So, like, figure out, you know, what you want that money to go towards, because the money is coming.
Yeah.
Like, if he told them $1 billion and he went in knowing it was a $1 billion bill anyway, then, like, I applaud him for coming to us with 2.3, because no Democrat has tried anything that bold in basically my entire lifetime.
True. Yeah.
So, like, good on him for trying a thing, if that's what happened. But if that's what happened, then I feel like the thing that I want in exchange for that is for all of that money to come from the very wealthy. And that is something that if they're doing it through reconciliation, he can say, we compromised with them. We came down from 2.3.
Right.
We came down more than half on our bill.
We just couldn't decide on how to pay for it. And all we want to do is raise the taxes on the billionaires by 0.3%.
We don't want to pay for it by taking funding out of other needed priorities or blah, blah, blah. We told them how we were going to pay for it. We came down to their figure. We negotiated.
Yeah.
But we're going to pay for it by taxing millionaires. Deal with your lives.
Yeah.
That would be kind of baller if he figured that, if he does that. I
don't know that they know how to message that properly. But
I know. They don't know how to message anything properly. And that really gets to the heart of why they annoy us so much. Because that, I think, is also potentially why their budget proposal annoys us, is it's not messaged properly, because they could have framed all of those big spending pieces as structural change if they chose to message it in such a way that it made it clear that this was intentionally sort of articulating a vision for the future that was meant to be structural change.
Yes. Right.
They didn't message it that way, because they didn't want to scare everyone. But, like, I feel like with this, let's scare some millionaires. What are we doing here, you guys? Like, we don't need to be walking around panicking that a bunch of people that hate our guts are going to hate our guts. They do. We did it. It's too late.
And we have seen time after time of them doing this exact same thing, where they just push a thing, where they act like they're coming to the table. They acted like they would listen to Obama on his healthcare plan, right? Yeah. I mean, like, these are things that we have seen them do on big bills, and they will ultimately, none of them will vote for it.
Not even
Shelley Moore Capito is going to vote for it. They're going to, like, slow walk it as long as they can, which is benefiting them because it's putting off him dealing with any of the rest of his agenda. They're just going to make him spend 6 weeks just, like, having nonsense talks in the White House, right? That they will all enjoy more than they should, by the way.
Well, they're all
including
friends.
Including
Biden. Yeah.
Right? And then at the end, you'll have to go through reconciliation and it'll be fucking 50-50 and Kamala Harris is going to have to go down to the Senate and decide the thing. So, like, this is all a joke. And at least, thankfully, I feel like we're, you know, Bernie Sanders has for weeks being like, let's get on with our lives here, right? But we're seeing a lot of that after this came out on Friday. So I think the Senate is probably getting close to probably, and they've probably been preparing to do this by reconciliation for a while anyway. But I mean,
I would imagine.
You've got people like, you know, Richard Blumenthal, who is no great progressive champion, like out there talking about like how this is a freaking joke. And it was like more, you know, Ron Wyden came out and was just like, this is not it. Sherrod Brown came out and was like, this is not what we're doing here. So I think Brian Schatz, again, we've moved on from the Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren types in the Senate
to just regular
Joe Blows in the Senate. Yeah. So hopefully that is signaling a sign of them being fed up enough with this that, like, maybe we can stop the charade a little
bit. I feel like I'm starting to see a strategy emerge, actually, with the way the White House and the Senate are working these bills, which is to say, listen, none of these people want structural change, so let's put that off the table for a moment to just say that they, in terms of their agenda to accomplish what they do want, which is not structural change, I feel like we see Biden going in and pretending he's going to negotiate with Republicans. We see them going in with bigger numbers than they intended to go in with, which is a smart, you know, that is something we've been saying they should do for a long time. And it does seem like that's part of their strategy.
Yeah.
It seems like the way they could message this in a way that the Republicans are just like the out and out losers of this.
Well, I think
thing.
So, too. And certainly,
and it seems like Schumer is interested in doing that. It seems like the Republicans in the Senate are interested. I mean, the Democrats in the Senate are interested in doing that. I don't know if Biden is interested in doing that.
The one thing that I do think that this gets him is that, especially, you know, in the midterms, which are still too far away, but one thing that the Republicans have been really hitting home messaging-wise is that he promised during the campaign that he would work with us and that he would be a good faith negotiator with us. And, like, they have been saying that, like, you know, he didn't do that with the COVID bill and he's not doing it with this and he's just trying to be a socialist, blah, 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 blah.
Couldn't be like, more good faith negotiating in the face of out and out insanity.
Right, exactly. So I guess maybe this steals that away from them just when it comes to, you know, the future messaging wars about whether he's been bipartisan enough.
Well, and I think that that's something that he, I would say of all the people who would be most adept at seeming bipartisan, it would be Joe Biden. I mean, preferred politician.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why he got elected.
I agree. And I think that that is also maybe an area where I don't trust almost anyone in the sort of moderate Democratic wing because they've ruined, you know, their messaging strategy multiple times in every, you know, time that they have power. I do think that if their strategy is to seem bipartisan, that Joe Biden is the guy to accomplish that. And he is doing if this is his strategy, he's been out there chatting with them, getting people like us to say that we're annoyed that he's talking to them so much, like all year so far.
Yeah.
And it will be easy to message that he tried.
Yeah.
If they don't fuck that up. And I think that probably quietly in the Senate, they know that nothing's ever going to come to anything. So this is all theater. So when you consider the theater of it instead of the meaningfulness of it, because we should remember that no one actually wants to accomplish anything in this body, so it doesn't matter what's happening, then they're playing the theater better than they have in the past.
True.
Now, the theater, listen, Joe Biden's not my guy. So, like, what he's trying to accomplish is not what I'm trying to accomplish.
Right.
So that continues to be a problem for me. But he is, I think, maybe playing what he's trying to accomplish smarter than past Democratic presidents of the recent era have, which I do feel good about. And if ever there was a guy who could claim he has the credibility of being bipartisan, it's somebody who loves the Hyde Amendment secretly in his heart and has basically one of the worst track records.
But that's one of the things.
I know
that's
one
not
of the things.
The,
they,
oh, yeah,
I know that
the
they
budget,
removed funding
yeah.
for the Hyde Amendment. That should not be controversial,
it should not
you
be.
Guys. That should not be controversial.
Yeah.
It and also end it permanently.
Yeah.
Repeal the Hyde Amendment. Don't just not fund it.
Yeah.
Get rid of it. He doesn't want to get rid of it because he loves the Hyde Amendment. Him and Tim Kaine probably chat about their love of the Hyde Amendment all over the place every day. So I can only imagine how much Hyde Amendment belovedness is happening. Yeah. He's one of the most pro-life Democrats that has basically like ever served in my lifetime. But I think that he is certainly somebody whose past conservatism gives him the credibility to claim that he is truly bipartisan.
Yeah.
And he is really playing up the theater of that.
True.
So much so that it's annoying.
It's so much so that it's annoying. That's it. That's my takeaway.
Yeah. No, it's annoying. It's not for us.
No, it's not for us.
It's not. And I think I'm having trouble also remembering sometimes that none of this is for us.
That's true.
He does not want to accomplish what we want to accomplish. I keep wanting to put all my hopes and dreams into him because it's like, what else do we have?
Right.
But like, he doesn't actually want what we want.
Right.
So like, I have to remember that and think, is he accomplishing what he wants to accomplish? Is this strategically smart for his agenda? Because it's not my agenda at all. So it's like, I have to take myself out of it.
Yeah. I guess I agree with you. I think he's making a strategic move that could benefit him in the way that you just described. Yeah. Right. I think the other strategic move that he could take that would benefit him, in my estimation, more than what it is that he's doing right now, is to just actually pass the campaign promises.
Right. Like actually improve people's lives.
Right.
That would be our agenda.
Right.
We're in it to make policy that improves lives.
Yes.
That's not his agenda.
Right.
Yeah. So if he did that, it would not be enacting his agenda. It would be enacting our agenda. And that's where I think I'm having to remember.
Yeah, right.
That he is not me, that we are not together in this.
Well, maybe you'll just have to continue to remind me of that because I don't know that I'm...
I don't know that I'm capable of reminding myself. I don't think it's worth remembering, though, because I think our responsibility as
Is to not just allow him this.
Exactly.
It's to continue to, like, say the shit that we're saying.
This is like a psychological argument that I'm making to myself out of the curiosity of the science of it all. But I don't think that our responsibility as advocates of other policy is to believe that.
Yeah, okay.
That's good, a Democrat. That's what the Democrats would do.
That it is.
Is they would believe that nothing is possible because no one wants to do anything. That is not what progressives do.
Yeah.
It's an inherently optimistic position to be a progressive. We say it all the time on the podcast.
Yeah.
And that is because you have to believe in things that don't make any sense. In any case.
Oh boy.
Listen, I don't think we're gonna get a January 6th commission.
We're gonna get a Democratic-led one.
I mean, right, we're going to get a commission, which is probably better, honestly.
I mean, it might be.
I don't actually know that I wanted the Republicans' cooperation on this. Do we need someone obscuring all the points that are going to come out? Because at some point, information is going to come out that, first of all, it doesn't matter what comes out. If it makes the Republicans look bad, they're going to claim shenanigans, and their voters are going to believe that it was a farce.
Yeah.
So whether or not they're involved is sort of like irrelevant to the question.
Sure.
The question is whether other people who believe in facts and such, who are not like in a cult, are able to be like, is there something we could do to prevent this?
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that the question is really like, are we going to convince cult members that their cult is bad?
Yeah.
Because that's not how it works. What you do is you slowly introduce them to a shared reality that has nothing to do with the cult. And then you hope that they'll notice that you're reasonable. So maybe some of the things you're saying aren't crazy.
Right.
And that is what we have to seek to do with our cult member friends.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I've been watching a lot of cult-related TV programming and listening to a lot of cult-related podcasts, and this is the conclusion that I came to. And I had to advise my mother in this because she has a neighbor who put up a very distasteful flag in front of their house, and she's furious about it.
Oh.
And she was ready to just, you know, raise a ruckus over it. And I was like, why don't you engage them instead in town matters, which is a shared reality that is sort of divorced of politics because they have their own political party in the town that's a sort of non-entity. They run in like a non-party party.
Oh, yeah.
So they have a local party and all of their town council candidates run on that local party.
Okay.
And so so it's sort of like divorced of the context of like national politics. And I was like, if you like engage them on that first and make them know that you are not like an insane person.
Yeah.
And then once you're in a shared reality, they might start to think that you, a non-insane person, are not spewing insane things, that you are together in this shared reality, also just responding to things that you know and hear.
Yeah.
And that is how you pull them out of the cult. You don't pull them out of the cult by telling them that they're in a cult. If someone told me I was in a cult right now, I'd be like, fuck off. I'm free thinking, you know, but maybe I'm in a cult. I don't know. Like, you know, you have to share a reality first.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's what I'm advising everyone do now, even though it's less satisfying than just telling people they're being fucking idiots.
Right.
Because it's just like, we're past the point where we can tell people they're fucking idiots. Like, it's not working.
It's not working.
You know? No. In any case, my point is, I don't think it matters if the Democrats or a bipartisan committee run a report on this, because it's for Democrats anyway.
Yes. I agree. And I think the reason that the Republicans didn't want any part of it is because they just don't want the facts to fully come out. But it
would
seems
be terrible
like
for them.
Right, exactly. And it just would have been, it also would have been terrible for the 10 who had to sit on the thing.
Yes.
They would have never been reelected.
It would ruin their careers. Now, mostly it was a party line vote. 6 Republicans voted alongside the Dems in the Senate. So the House had already passed it.
Yeah.
And with a, you know, remember we talked about it last week. The Problem Causers Caucus got on board.
Oh, yeah. Because, and so, well, and they gave the Republicans everything they wanted. I mean, it was an equal split on who right. was going to be on it. So it wasn't even,
the
there was
moderate
no way
Republicans
to say that it
were
was
on
bipartisan.
Board.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. And so 35 of them voted in the
yeah,
House
quite
for
a bit.
It. In the Senate, the procedural vote failed with 54 to 35. 6 Republicans voted with the Democrats, but you might notice via math that that means 2 Democrats abstained. And that includes one, Kristen Sinema, who had previously called such a investigation critical.
Critical.
It was so critical that she couldn't vote on whether or not we should have one.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Republicans that voted with the Dems are like the obvious ones. It's like Mitt Romney and Susan Collins and Rob Portman and Ben Sasse, who I never thought would be one of the moderate. Like, I'm so confused about what's happening.
He just hates Trump, I think. I think it's like a personal.
He's as nutty as they come. Yeah. I love Pat Toomey, who I think voted to impeach Trump, did not vote. And he said it was because he had a family obligation, but that he would have voted to continue the investigation. It's like, well, it was a pretty close vote. So maybe you would have wanted to show up if you believed that.
Yeah.
But he didn't. So that's.
Yeah.
Murkowski's kind of pissed about it. She made an impassioned speech on the floor of the Senate. But it's also like, what does that do? Who's trusting Lisa Murkowski?
No.
Nobody.
None of her own colleagues.
None of her own colleagues.
Certainly.
Well, and that's also the police officer that was killed, his mother came and lobbied for as well.
That
no one cared.
Matter. No.
Sad stories on the Hill. They hear those all day.
Right.
People come all day and tell them sad stories about whatever.
Yeah, they're
immune to that. They don't care. But so, in any case, we'll see what the Democrats come up with, because no one else is coming up with anything.
Lord have mercy.
But New York City is on the case.
Yeah.
Because the Manhattan DA, Cy Vance, convened a grand jury to decide whether they're going to indict Trump.
So good.
Or executives at Trump, you know, Trump Inc. or whatever.
Yeah, I think they're like looking into like his finance guy or something like that. That's how they feel like they're going to get to him or whatever.
But a grand jury is something you only do if you think you have the evidence. You don't just like be convening grand juries left and right.
Right. That's what everybody.
It wastes people's time immensely. Grand juries take months and people do not like to be on them.
I hear you get donuts at them, though.
Yes, you probably do get. They would need to give you donuts because, although this is just the kind of thing Republicans would cut from a budget, is the donuts for the grand jury. It's like how, you know, I've been on a federal advisory committee, and one of the most annoying rules about it is that you are not allowed, they're not allowed to bring any food or water for you. And so not only can you not have food or water in the room, but like you have to buy your own lunch after they force you to come to an all-day meeting that is also kind of a boring meeting. And it's because of, you know, rules about, you know, it's because of a bunch of ethics rules that were passed essentially to just like deprive people of an interest in doing these committees so that experts wouldn't do them.
Yeah.
But it's rude, is my point.
Trump, of course, called it a continuation of the greatest witch hunt in American history. This is purely political and an affront to the almost 75 million voters who supported me in the presidential election. And it's being driven by highly partisan Democrat prosecutors.
Here's a thing I want to say to Donald Trump, if he's listening.
Yeah.
Stop saying the number. The number makes you sound pathetic.
Yes.
Because we know it's a smaller number than the winner's number.
Right. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether 1 trillion people voted for you.
If 1 trillion and 3
and
people
from Mars voted for you. If more people voted for the other person, like, you lost.
Right. Like, saying the number reminds us that we know the numbers.
Right.
If you said nothing and you just called it a witch hunt, we might forget what had happened. But instead, you remind us constantly that you literally got
lost
fewer votes.
Lost an election.
Right. And that you not only got fewer votes overall, but in the states that mattered, you also got fewer votes. Everywhere that mattered, you got fewer votes. So, like, stop reminding us about that. This is not good messaging.
Yeah.
It's so funny to me that he is basically, I know it's because he got more votes in that election than he did in the first one. So he's thinking to himself that he bested himself. And so he deserved to win because he bested himself.
Yeah.
But, like, That's because he doesn't understand things. Well, he does understand things, but that's because he doesn't want us to understand things. In any case, there are already some discussions going on about who is and is not planning to run for various seats that are up in 2022. And one of those is the is Marco Rubio's Senate seat.
Yes.
And it's now looking like Val Demings is eyeing that seat.
Amazing.
She was talking about running for governor.
Yeah. I mean, look, is Val Demings my favorite person ever? No. Do I, would I obviously love her to beat Marco Rubio? Of course.
Yes.
And like, I think that there are some things that make me feel like she could. There are some things that make me feel like maybe she's not as exciting as some people might think that she is. But I mean, like, it certainly, if nothing else, it makes that competitive in a way that you would think that the Republicans at large were, would hope that maybe that specific Senate race wouldn't be.
Exactly.
And that, I think, is helpful literally for every other Senate race. Like, if you've got Republicans running around like chickens with their heads cut off, spending tens of millions of dollars in Florida on Marco Rubio, who you would think would maybe be safe.
Yeah.
That's a problem for them, so that's good for everybody else.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like the thing that makes me happy about this is, first of all, the name, the other Democrats that were sort of in the mix for this are like Alan Grayson again.
Who,
like,
I love.
I love, like, Alan Grayson.
Right, no,
he
I get,
doesn't
I'm
ever win
you.
These seats.
No, he doesn't.
Get out
no,
of town. Like, don't, yeah. I don't want to hear that Alan Grayson is the candidate because he doesn't win.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's, and the you know, there's a former prosecutor they're talking about running. Stephanie Murphy is talking about running. These are not people that have the profile of Val Demings in or outside of Florida. I think, you know, Val Demings, I think, had two kind of lucky breaks happen in the last few years because, A, she was on the short list for Biden, so that's how a lot of people got to meet her. But also, she was on the first impeachment team.
Yeah.
And so she's been fairly visible of late. And I think I have a kind of crazy theory that may be true or not, which is, you know, I think one of the knocks against her with her own base would be that she has a law enforcement background. Because we're not so keen on law enforcement these days.
Right.
I think that in Florida that might work.
I was
going to
say the left isn't.
Right.
But like maybe.
But like,
that's
who else
okay.
are they going to vote for?
Right. Well, and also I think, you know, I mean, I just sort of advocated for not playing identity politics, but like there is not a black woman in the Senate any longer.
Right.
Which, you know, there should be.
Right.
You know, like, and it would be great if it was Val Demings. You know,
right.
I mean, like, perfectly like. Would be a good
also
senator.
In the identity politics war, she can really go toe-to-toe with Marco Rubio on just like a working class origin story that is fit for politics.
Right.
The GOP loves to talk about being the children of bartenders, or, you know, it's like how John Boehner was driven to tears by his own origin
every
story
time
every time he thought about his own past. But Marco Rubio is sort of in a similar situation where, you know, he talks a lot about being the son of a bar, of a maid and a bartender, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so already they're really driving the line of Val Demings being the daughter of a maid and a janitor. So they're just going to be talking constantly about what working class jobs their parents had and how that impacted them. I think the difference is that Val Demings is going to be able to say that she went into a kind of public service that didn't leave her being sort of on the edge of indicted repeatedly during her career in state politics, like Marco Rubio, or, you know, in local state politics.
Yeah.
I think they're basically trying to drive home the point that he basically became a career politician and that she went into what is a kind of public service. I don't know that it's going to be the kind that really catches the imagination of people at the moment. But again, Florida, I don't know.
I don't know either.
I don't know what goes on in Florida.
Oh, God.
You
don't,
know,
don't
want
to know.
She's moderate.
She is.
They'll probably eat that up in Florida. I don't know what goes on. Maybe they won't. I don't. Maybe a socialist could win Florida. I like truly don't know who the voters in Florida are, except for I know that there's a lot of elderly Jewish people who are socialists. So it feels like those people could elect a socialist.
Yeah.
I don't know who else is there.
Yeah.
I'm not even curious. It's the state scares me, but I feel like this could be not a knock on her if in the right.
I know. No,
if what I know about Florida, which is not much, is true. In any case, speaking of Florida,
God,
Matt Gaetz is a man who might be in jail.
I was going to say,
in 2022.
Continues to act as though he will be anywhere other than jail in 2024 when he would be running a presidential campaign.
Right. He's the man who, as we said in the rundown, most wants Donald Trump to just drop dead.
Right.
He is a supporter of Donald Trump in the sense that he wants Donald Trump to sort of bequeath him a sort of a demo of lunatics who want to vote for lunacy. Right. But he does not want Donald Trump to be alive in 2024 because he wants to be the chosen successor in 2024.
Right. And he sent a text message to the New York Post.
First of all, what? This is, he announced to the New York Post via text message that he's thinking of running for president.
Yeah, that's right. He said, I support Donald Trump for president. I've directly encouraged him to run, and he gives me every indication he will. If Trump doesn't run, I'm sure I could defeat whatever remains of Joe Biden by 2024. Ooh, he's got the jokes.
Well, he's getting practice on his America First tour.
Yes, of course. Right. Everybody's really loving that.
My favorite thing about the Matt Gaetz stump speech right now is the way that Matt Gaetz, a man who is our age, who was a small child at the time that Ronald Reagan was president, goes on about the memory of Ronald Reagan as if that was a forward-thinking presidency, which he doesn't remember because he was not old enough to remember because I was not old enough to remember. When I talk about Ronald Reagan, I'm making everything up. It is entirely hearsay what I say about Ronald Reagan because I don't remember anything about Ronald Reagan. I remember that in the Reagan era, I lived near a tent city that had a massive drug problem. I remember that in the Reagan era, there seemed to be a lot of strife in New York City. I remember that in the Reagan era, my parents used to be like, the president has Alzheimer's. But I don't remember the day-to-day of the Reagan era, as I was not an adult.
No, neither does Matt Gaetz.
But he says, you know, as part of his stump speech, it's been too many years since an inspirational President Ronald Reagan told us that it was morning in America again. Too often now, it seems like it's the twilight for Joe Biden, which is not America. That's even if it's the twilight for Joe Biden, that has nothing to do with it being morning or evening in America.
Yeah.
If it was morning in America under Reagan, it sort of seems like nap time in America when Joe Biden is the president, which is so preferable to the afternoon in America that we had with Donald Trump. But whatever. I think it's about time to wake up our fellow countrymen.
Good.
He's referring to a president who was in the twilight of his life to the extent that he had dementia while serving as president. Mm-hmm. And his wife was basically like secretly running things. Again, based on hearsay. I don't remember this.
Yeah, sure.
But I mean, this is the way, like, I know that the Republicans have this tendency to sort of like fondly remember Reagan, who would be horrified, you know, who would would want nothing to do with Matt Gaetz.
Wouldn't even want to be associated with him in any way, shape, or form.
Ronald Reagan would have been at this year's DNC. But that point aside, I feel like the fact that Matt Gaetz, who is like a full lunatic, is continuing, is sort of like, he's taking like an impressionist painting of the Ronald Reagan of the Republican Party's memory and kind of like rearranging it in a funny way. And he has no qualms about doing it because he has no memory of Ronald Reagan.
Right.
And so it's easy to kind of like pretend like you're the future by referencing this, you know, storied figure in the Republican Party. But he doesn't know anything about Ronald Reagan.
No, he doesn't.
Like all of us, because we are too young to remember Ronald Reagan.
That's right. Yeah. He does know something about paying minors for sex, though.
That's true. And apparently, another favorite thing that he's been saying recently, he told this specifically, this quote specifically comes from a talk he was giving to a bunch of Republicans in Ohio. I'm falsely accused of exchanging money for naughty favors. Yet Congress has reinstituted a process that legalizes the corrupt act of exchanging money for favors through earmarks, and everybody knows that's the corruption. I think that he is trying to equate paying minors for sex with pork spending.
No, that's exactly
in this quote.
It's literally what he is doing.
And I think that's, I mean, it's genius. It's crazy. But what a time. I mean, what an idea.
Uh-huh. Oh, man.
He is somebody who that believes that the moral equivalent of paying a minor for sex, again, a minor,
is getting some money sent back to your district.
That's right. It's pork spending. Like, I don't even know where to begin with that, but I just love that he tried. I mean, that's ballsy. You got to give him credit for being ballsy, because that is a crazy thing to say.
It is.
And he said it in public. It's recorded. It was written down. I mean, that is,
God, that guy.
What a time.
What a time. Guys, Tom Perez.
Another ballsy guy.
This fucking guy.
First of all,
this guy.
We've been mad at him for so many reasons over the years that I can't even figure out where to start with this.
Yeah.
But, you know, Tom Perez, a man who took over the DNC at a time that specifically they were looking for somebody who was on good terms with the left because the DNC had been funneling money to the Clinton campaign and everyone was mad about it.
Right.
So this is a guy who takes over the DNC at a time specifically to calm the left.
Mm-hmm. Didn't.
Didn't. succeed at doing that.
No.
Instead, basically, like, cleaned house and appointed a bunch of, like, establishment figures to, like, go vote down anything that would have, you know, made the left happy.
And a sign that we should have seen what Obama did to Bernie Sanders coming.
Yeah.
This was Obama's doing when we were about to have Keith Ellison.
That's right.
Somebody
who might have been on good terms with the left because he is on good terms with the left.
Right.
In any case, Tom Perez leaving the DNC. As we know, Jamie Harrison is going to be the new DNC chair. A man with a past as a lobbyist, but whatever. Tom Perez has decided to go full evil villain and join Jay Carney in union busting hell because he is going to take a job as a partner at a law firm in DC that is also a lobbying firm called Venable.
Sure.
That basically advertises services as union bust, as a union busting firm.
I feel like we've talked about them before.
I think we have too. Because I think they are a major union busting firm.
Yeah. And I think somebody else went there too.
Well, I'm sure.
I
think in Tom Perez's case, it's important to point out that this man used to be the fucking labor secretary. So this is not just some Jay Carney asshat telling us that Amazon pays $15 an hour, so everyone should shut their mouth because that's a great wage for America.
Right. Jay Carney, former Obama, was press secretary, wasn't he?
Isn't that what he was? Yeah, I think he was the press secretary.
Yeah, he was the press secretary.
Anyway, he now is a flack for Amazon.
Yeah.
And was busy during the Bessemer, you know.
Quite. Yeah.
Situation telling us how great Amazon is, so we shouldn't bother unionizing them. In any case, Tom Perez, a labor secretary, a former labor secretary, a man who has served in the capacity of protecting laborers.
I was going to say, well, he knows a lot about unions. So this makes perfect sense that he would go to a place that could bust
them. Lot about unions. So much so that you would think that maybe he would hope they were a good idea. I don't know. But in any case, I feel like this is, A, the perfect end to the Tom Perez chapter of our lives.
Totally.
Because this is exactly what Tom Perez would do. But also, fuck all of these Obama people who, like, no wonder things didn't change for working people under the Obama administration.
Yep.
Because every single fucking person that they, you know, every single person that they had protecting labor, like, went into the revolving door of lobbying to unprotect labor.
Yep.
As soon as they were out of the, you know, out of the limelight. And this is sort of a larger problem that maybe we could, that we should think about when we think about why we don't share a vision with Joe Biden. Right. Because the kinds of establishment figures that Perez was elevating in the DNC, who first of all then went, you know, on the executive committee and voted to make it, you know, voted against policies that would have made it impossible for people involved, you know, with big corporations to be in the executive committee, that would have banned corporate money, that, you know, all of the things that the left wanted to do to clean up the DNC were voted down by the people that when Perez cleaned house that he replaced them with.
Yeah.
And so the DNC is as corrupt as it was when he got there.
Yep.
He is now going to take all of his knowledge as labor secretary and give it to a firm that makes money busting unions.
Yep.
And also, by the way, Venable does a lot
defense
of
defense contracting,
corporate lobbying for other industries.
Represents
as well.
Gas companies,
right?
American Airlines,
Citadel, who you might remember from the GameStop situation.
Yeah.
So they represent a litany of evil corporations. And he is working there in legislative and government affairs,
although he's
not yet a registered lobbyist. But that can include lobbying, is sort of the final act of the Labor Department, the Obama Labor Department.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I hope it can be.
It's not going to be
the final act of it.
Because, like, Jamie Harrison,
get gone, all of you,
is not.
I know, not better.
First of all, Jamie Harrison is a former Clyburn staffer. So I already am mad at him. I've been mad at him about that for a while.
Yeah.
And I've said nice things about him in the past. Not
Jamie Harrison.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
not
have I.
Great nice things. I mean, but, like, medium nice things about him.
Yeah.
But he's a former lobbyist himself. He was counsel for Clyburn, who everyone knows I have issues with. But he also, and this is something I had forgotten. I think we knew this because we talked about it at one point. But he worked for the Podesta Group.
Ugh.
And I have, there's a lot of reasons I don't like the Podesta Group. One being that they take, you know, they lobby on the behalf of big corporations.
Yeah.
The other being that John Podesta is involved in it,
and there's no one
I hate more than John Podesta.
Yeah, there you go.
And
let's
also
get to the heart of it.
There's no one who I think embodies or encapsulates what I dislike about moderate Democrats more than John Podesta. Because he will condescendingly tell you a bunch of things about how nothing can change and young people should shut the fuck up while running the Podesta Group and representing Wells Fargo and Walmart and Bank of America and BP and stuff.
Yeah.
So that's who John Podesta is.
Yeah.
And that is who Jamie Harrison was lobbying for when he was prior to, you know, working for James Clyburn or maybe right after working for James Clyburn.
Yeah, they represented Boeing, Bank of America, BP America, Wells Fargo, Walmart. I'm like, you know, all of America's amazing, great corporations.
To summarize, the DNC is not in better hands.
No.
The DNC also basically under Perez had no state structure.
Yeah.
So the DNC was not even fulfilling its responsibility to help people get elected.
Yeah.
The former labor secretary and former DNC head is now working as a union buster.
Yeah.
The former colleague of his who helped sell their messages to the public is working as a union buster. And we currently live in a society where almost nobody has union representation. Wages have been stagnant or decreasing for decades, and we have no healthcare. So that's what's going on here.
Well, then, knowing all of those things, then I think maybe the DNC is in great hands with Jamie Harrison.
It's going to continue the great work it's been
doing. They're in the hands that they deserve.
Yeah, they want to be in. They're in the hands that they look forward to being in.
Yeah. Oh, God. Texas nightmare. Democrats. God bless them. I feel like this is probably, this is what, you know, national Democrats should take a note here. Because I feel like this is the thing that you probably end up having to do when you're in a state that is like perpetually red. Yeah. And you have to think up a thing to do when they are about to, you know, pass one of the most restrictive voting bills in the U.S. You literally leave and lock the fucking door so they can't vote on it.
You do some theater. You have to do some theater. That is, and also Texas Democrats, I feel like, are actually like usually pretty serious business Democrats. I mean, when Democrats come out of Texas,
well, yeah, it's like you have to be.
You have to be like really fucking hardcore to be a Democrat in Texas. Yeah. And so the Democrats in Texas are awesome when they get out of Texas. But also, I feel like all you have left as a Democrat in Texas is theater at a certain point.
Yeah.
And so what I wish that the Democrats had embraced during the Trump administration was theater. Because sometimes that is all you have left.
How many times have we just said something to the effect of like, just do a thing?
Anything. Just come up with an idea. A crazy idea.
Yeah.
It's like, throw snowballs on the House floor. Yeah. Like, do anything.
Yep.
Like, have a pizza party there. It's whatever you do. But so in any case, this Texas voting bill is bananas.
Yeah, it's one of the worst ones.
And that's already a terrible state to vote in.
Right.
I mean, that's, you know. Not what you're looking for in a voting state. Anyway, that's one of those states, I think, where you can like use your gun license but not your student ID as a voter ID.
Yeah.
Like, that's the kind of thing they're up to in Texas. Yeah. In any case, they're trying to make it even worse. They have a bill, Senate Bill 7, that is aiming to essentially be the most restrictive voting bill in the United States. They want to be number one at being terrible. But they had a midnight deadline on a legislative session where they were going to vote on it, and the Democrats just started leaving one by one so that they wouldn't have a quorum. Jesus. And just walked out. Which is, look, I'm of two minds about this. One being that those theater moves never work. Like, this bill is going to pass.
This bill, well, yeah, they're going to have an emergency session. But, like, I think it draws...
But it draws attention.
Draws attention to it, right. We weren't knowing that... we knew, because we knew that every single Republican-led state has some sort of, like, you know... a bill like this that's working its way through the legislature, but like, we weren't necessarily specifically focused on this one in Texas, and now we can be.
Exactly.
And again, I don't know if that helps or not.
But right. No, but I think it's important. I think it's important for, you know, there to be some sort of public outcry when something this restrictive and this ridiculous happens, because there has to be some momentum moving out of it that actually like can enact some sort of change. And really what we need is federal legislation. It's like, don't let Texas decide what they can do and can't do about voting. We have shown in the past that the federal government can intervene when states are making voting laws that are restrictive enough that they are trampling on people's, you know, constitutional right to cast a ballot.
Yep.
So the federal government can step in these situations, but we need them to pass a voting rights bill. And they have like two of them that are theoretically always imminent, but never actually happen. And what I think we need is to have a fire lit under the kinds of people who don't live in Texas or do live in Texas who can get legislators on board for this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that requires us to know that it's happening.
Yep.
You know, and to draw attention to how many other states it's happening in. So, you know, this is, I'm always in favor of political theater because I feel like, you know,
it's, oh yeah, for sure.
Politics is a messaging war. Theater is just messaging.
Right. Well, and I think also now that we're looking at this, like, we can actually, like, dig into how bad it is also. Exactly. Because, like, you know, again, like, just the focus wasn't directly on it, and now it is. And I think people are, like, looking at, like, holy shit, this thing is, like, I mean, not only is it just, like, bad, and I mean, all of these bills specifically, like, you know, direct, you know, people who already have a hard time voting, you know, and this specifically, I mean, there's a thing in there that's like, they've restricted voting hours specifically on Sunday, just because that's when a lot of black people go to the polls. They do their, you know, a lot of times they'll do their, like, what's it called? I can't remember. Where they, like, go from church, to the polls or whatever. They've limited specifically only the hours on Sunday just to, like, make sure that black people, that, like,
church
don't,
caravans
don't
are going
go,
to vote.
Don't
right.
go from church to go to vote. I mean, like, they're not even couching it in any sort of way that could be seen as anything other than just, like, outright racism of, like, not wanting specific groups to vote. No. This bill is crazy.
It's targeted at parts of the state that are Democratic. It's targeted at black voters. Like, it's targeted very specifically in, like you're saying, in uncouched ways that I think are meant to test the legal system, that are not, you know, and the fact that we have such poor sort of court representation at this point is not great.
No, it's not.
The other thing, though, I've been thinking this a lot as I've been watching these bills come through, which is just, like, at a certain point, they make it too hard to vote, and it makes it so that a lot of people can't show up. But it also, people don't, as my mom always says, people hate being cheated.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the time, these kinds of bills, when they're this overt, they backfire really dramatically because they can't actually make it impossible for people to vote. It has to be possible some way.
Right.
And whether they make that sliver of possibility, you know, difficult to, like, but people oftentimes will come in and fill those gaps when they need to in order to make it possible.
Well, you get people riled up. And I think actually the Democrats...
It's a great organizing tactic for the Democrats.
Well, and the Democrats did the exact thing that they should have because they walked from the legislative session that they walked out of to a black church to have a giant protest.
Exactly.
So, like, you're right. I mean, hopefully that will be the case because, like, sometimes these just end up being so restrictive that you're just generally
fucked.
Right,
no, I mean,
but, like,
it's a huge obstacle.
Right.
But it's not smart messaging strategy for the Republicans. And it's also often not smart practical strategy for them because people hate when you do this.
Right.
And those church caravans, if they have to go on Saturday to prove a point,
they will.
Right,
of course.
And it will be annoying for everyone. And it will be difficult. And it will be expensive. And, like, all of those things
but
will be
will
true.
But they will make damn well sure that they do.
But they will cast a ballot whether or not they care about the candidates.
Yeah.
Because, like, it's easier to get people to not vote via apathy than via restrictive voting measures a lot of the time.
I agree, especially
because this makes it so important that everyone vote that you're like, well, I'm going to plan for 3 months to vote. I got to vote.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people have been voting in a lot of states under incredibly restrictive, you know, voting laws for a long time in places that you think of as, like, not being super, you know, Republican.
Oh, sure.
Because the entire East Coast has just, like, crazy voting laws that no one can explain.
Even in Georgia, the voting laws in Georgia were already terrible.
Right.
I mean, granted, they just made them
worse.
But I mean, like, you know, we just won a presidential election in two Senate seats in Georgia, which we hadn't won in decades. And I think in large part, it was probably due to the fact that Brian Kemp stole the last election.
Yeah. And the other thing that happens is there becomes a point where it stops being beneficial to the businesses this is meant to serve, to the wealthy, you know. Like,
the Texas businesses have already come out against this.
I mean, I don't think that they are coming out in good faith because I don't think they care as much as
they
should.
Either. I mean,
we
could do a whole podcast on how I feel about
brands
political
having,
stances on this. I agree more with Mitch McConnell than I would like to.
Yeah. I mean, like, I think that at a certain point, this becomes problematic for them because it's like a problem that they create where then if they don't win under these circumstances, they have to do what Donald Trump is doing where they pretend it was stolen and they send it to the court.
Yeah.
And then they actually do have to just steal the election, which actually makes it so obvious that that's when big changes happen. About how the Voting Rights Act happened, it didn't happen because tiny little choices were being made in towns that no one was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It happened because big election stealing bigness was happening. You know, it happened because a large scale problem was visible to everybody.
Yeah.
And that's what happens when you push things this far. I just don't think it's like, they're not long game players anymore. And they used to be such genius long game players, the Republicans.
It's true.
I don't know what is going on with them. I'm actually thinking that, like, the Biden Democrats are better long game players at this moment. And I don't like feeling that way because I've never trusted them to be long game players. But like, it just like the Republicans seem like they're really not thinking about more than 1 second into the future with this, because this is how you get slapped back with a huge voting rights package.
Totally.
You know,
I agree.
Maybe it takes a few years. Maybe it's terrible. Maybe while it's not happening, everything is, I mean, like, you know, I'm not suggesting it's that we want to live with the consequences of this, but I'm just saying like, this is how you show that there's a problem.
Yeah. I agree.
In any case, a final question of the week. Why did Brent and I get vaccinated before Kate Middleton?
This was, I saw this headline earlier today and I thought for certain that I had read
it. It was
old
news. I thought it was, I was like, oh, I missed this article from 3 months ago.
Yeah.
Like,
and why did she wait so long, actually? Because she's been eligible in California for months now at this point.
She's been eligible in Britain probably for months. It's like, what is, did they have to wait because there was some, they had to look like they weren't jumping in line? Everyone expects them to jump in line.
Yeah, and also they wouldn't have been jumping in line. Like, the jumping in line stopped, like, what was it? Wasn't it like May 15th or something that like anybody in, or maybe that was just LA. I can't remember. Even in other, they're in a different part of the state, I think, actually. Aren't they? I can't remember.
No, it wasn't.
But they're in California. But
no, I mean, they're not in California. It was Princess Kate.
Oh, Prince. Oh, my gosh. Sorry. Yes.
Kate Middleton.
Even still.
Not.
Oh, yeah. Kate Middleton. Not. Right.
The other royals.
Sorry. But yes, even still. Although they're having vaccine rollout issues over there.
Yeah. All of Europe is. But it makes you feel like the royals would have gotten it done secretly.
Yeah. I'm surprised that she just didn't get it and then they just didn't have to put out a story about it.
That's what I would do if I was royal.
Unless.
You go through the trouble of being royal and you're not going to get a vaccine before everyone else.
Unless. They're now doing it as like, do people like her?
I don't know.
Is this like a thing where it's just sort of like a new push to like try and get people to go get it?
Well, I also wonder if she got her first one months ago because they were extending the wait
time.
They
did do that, actually. Yes, they were.
And so maybe she has actually been.
If she got two different ones. I think they're doing that over there now too.
Oh yeah, they're up to anything there. You can get any kind of vaccine you want, any combination.
Uh-huh.
Maybe you can get three. I don't know what's happening there.
Yeah.
But I wonder if she got her first one like months ago.
Maybe.
In any case, it was weird because this news came out and I was like, am I?
Yeah, it was a confusing
way
headline.
More vaccinated.
It was especially confusing
than, like,
for me because I didn't even know who
we were talking
I had the wrong
about.
Person. But either way.
I wouldn't say that we're necessarily experts on the royals, so I don't know.
I'm not a person who sort of follows really gets into that.
No,
much.
I don't know why
I did
any
watch
Americans
that Oprah
are.
Interview, but
I
like,
didn't.
Everybody did.
I mean,
you didn't?
No,
oh,
I
that's right.
Watched
I remember
clips
I
of it. I made
that.
You tell me what had happened because I didn't feel like watching it.
Yeah.
I just, it turned out, didn't care. And that.
Good,
it turned
you shouldn't.
Out, it turned None
out of us should.
To
what
be,
are we doing caring?
It turned out to be a bigger obstacle to watching it than I even expected.
Yeah.
But yeah, it seems like a little weird that I'm more vaccinated.
I mean, I guess if that was because they were waiting for something, then like good, I guess, maybe or something. But
I have a lot of curiosity about the kind of people.
I know a couple people who live over there who are fully vaccinated.
Yes. Everyone I know who lives over
there
is fully
So I don't know
vaccinated.
What the exact rollout is, but like
it's,
obviously.
It's been long rolled in her situation. It's like, I know that they're having vaccine issues in like France and Germany, but Britain has been vaccinating people.
Okay.
They're one of the more highly vaccinated European countries.
They are.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah.
And they started doing it much earlier than the other European countries. So I just have a lot of curiosity about what was going on over there.
Interesting.
And it's weird that it made the American news because of us not needing to care at all.
If you know, tell us because
right.
we
Tweet
are not going
something.
To dig in any further than we have.
I'm
which
not
was
even going to Google
reading a
it.
Headline.
That's right.
That's all we did. We looked
yeah,
at a headline.
Yeah, we didn't even pull any information about this. I just saw a picture of her getting
a
the vaccine.
Bold question at the bottom of our
and I was like,
podcast document.
That's weird. Then I just didn't even look into it further than that.
Yeah.
So that's the full news this week.
That's it.
That's all there is.
And hopefully it was exciting for you as our dear listeners to have us back in the same room. I don't
that's
know
right.
if it... Tell us if it felt different.
Right. Maybe there was less digital noise, more digital noise.
Who knows?
We'll see. And we'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.